What's up, everybody? Welcome to a new podcast, new coverage, hosted by yours truly, Rayfield Davis, and your own Trey Demps. We got a special guest today from the Flying Illini, national broadcaster, Final Four, NBA, basketball guru, what have you, mentor, inspiration, all of the above, Stephen Bardo. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Rayfield. I got to bottle that, fellas. That's a great introduction. I appreciate it.
Nah, you a walking legend, man.
Oh, I don't know. To my mom, that's about it.
Steve, I know, like you said, I got my introduction while I was in college. You were in the broadcasting world. I was schooled by my coaches on your playing days and what you meant to not only Illinois, but the Big Ten, but even on a national level in college. But before all of that, you take it back to your early days. Who was that person that put that ball in your hand, or did you start out with a basketball, or kind of how was it like coming up where you were from?
You know what, guys? I was very fortunate to be born into a family that basketball was our family business. My dad played college basketball at Southern Illinois University in the late 50s, early 60s. He became a professor at SIU, and so we grew up in Carbondale, and it was really an ideal upbringing. You know, you've got a town of maybe 30,000 people with a large university there. So, you know, it's safer. I could run around. I could do whatever I wanted to. My brother played in Indiana the year they won the national championship with Isaiah Thomas. My sister played junior college basketball, and I'm the baby. So I was the beneficiary of a lot of basketball. And, you know, I just came into a family where basketball was paramount. So I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your upbringing in Carbondale. Did you have, like, a chip on your shoulder, you know, being from a small town? You know, there's a ton of guys that you're playing against that are from the city. Did you have that kind of chip on your shoulder as a basketball player growing up?
I did, Trey. And I was very fortunate because my dad was very smart. He knew that he had to throw me into some competitive situations outside of Southern Illinois because I was going to dominate that. He could see that, but right. He needed me to get to Chicago, to St. Louis, to Kansas State University's camp, to Bradley University's camp, to BC All-American, to five-star. I mean, I did them all because this was before AAU really got big.
Right.
And so you had to go the camp route to kind of get the exposure. And so my dad did a really good job of throwing me in the mix in a lot of different areas because, as you said, you do grow up with a chip on your shoulder coming from a smaller place because we didn't feel like we got the recognition. But when I got to Illinois, I was busting folks' asses, and they figured it out pretty quickly.
I
was going to say, was there a player, like, when you were young, you know, you think you that dude, and then you go to one of these camps. Was there that one player that you saw and you were like, oh, snap, I got to really step my game up?
There was about 100. I mean, you know, because, man, when you growing up, and one of the benefits I had, guys, I don't know if you guys are like this, I always played against older players. Mm-hmm. For the majority of my time coming up, I was always playing up. I was always playing guys a year or two or sometimes even 3 years older. So they were bigger, stronger, faster. And I had to figure it out. I had to figure out how to stay on the court and compete. And so I'm telling you, Trey, BC All-American camp, there was Sean Elliott. You guys remember Sean Elliott that played with the Spurs? Oh, man, this guy comes from Arizona. He's 6'8". I mean, he's as athletic as I've ever seen. And I did well. I made the All-Star team in that camp. But I had a few guys that ate my, you know, that took my lunch from me. And so, yeah, that happened on a consistent basis.
When did you realize, after, like you just said, you leave your town, you run into some guys, tough. But when did you realize that this could be my thing, basketball, I could take this to the next level? You see your brother in Indiana, your father's played college basketball. When did you know that was your path?
You know, I think it was at the Bradley camp. Rayfield, Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. That was kind of the first start. But what I really had my coming out party is not far from where you grew up, Rayfield, Rensselaer, Indiana. It used to be the BC All-American camp. And I went in there, and for some reason, I started hanging around these guys from Gary, Indiana, because they were crazy. They were fun, they were crazy, and they played hard. And I played hard, so I started hanging around with them. And they saw me play the first day at BC All-American camp, and they changed the way that they dealt with me. Because we were cool when we first got there, but when they saw me play, it became more adversarial. And so I was talking to my dad, and I was like, man, I thought I was cool with these guys. I said, Steven, you know what it is? They thought you couldn't play. So, they were cool when they thought you couldn't play. When they saw that you could flat out play, that's when things changed. So that was an eye-opening experience, because I came home for that camp and my dad said, Steven, how'd you do? And I said, yeah, I did all right. And I ran outside. A week later, I got flooded with college letters and coaches. And Dad came back. He said, Steven, how'd you do at this camp? I said, I made an all-star team, but whatever. And he just shook his head, because he's like, that's a big deal, but I didn't think it was a big deal at the time. So that was probably my coming out party.
So what's up? And out of those schools that came in early, was there anybody that you had been wanting to come in, anybody you were fascinated with, any coaches that you could kind of remember those initial conversations?
Man, listen, the Black America's team during that time was Georgetown University. And when I got a letter from Georgetown, I lost my mind. And, a letter doesn't mean anything. That means, they just send it out to 100, 200 prospects. Doesn't mean anything. But I took it as a big deal. And so I always wanted to play at Georgetown or Kentucky. So in Southern Illinois, Kentucky reigns supreme in college basketball. It's not the big – it's the Big Ten now. But back then, Kentucky was really, really popular. And so Kentucky – Louisville were teams that I was really hoping would come in. They came in late after I committed to Illinois, and I'm glad I kept my word because I was tempted to, kind of pull out of it a little bit. But Kentucky, Louisville, and Georgetown were the schools that, when they sent me something or showed me interest, it really made me feel good. But I'm really, really glad about my decision to play at Illinois.
Earlier, you mentioned your father's impact in, doing some research, a professor, intern, AD. What was his kind of impact in your upbringing, not only on the court, but also off the court?
Trey, that's a great question. My dad is my hero. My mom used to say, Harold, my dad's name, Harold. She said, Harold, if you stop moving, Steve's going to run right into your behind because he's always following. So that was my man. And, he gave me tough love like your fathers gave you two. Because, Trey, I know your dad and Raphael. Matt Painter told me about your dad, so I know you guys got the same kind of treatment I got.
Right.
And, he was always in my corner. He held me accountable, and he was my biggest supporter. And, when you have that kind of combination, you've got unconditional love, and which comes with discipline. Which comes with calling you out when it needs to. Absolutely. But also when you're down or something doesn't go right, they're the first to come and support you. So that's kind of how it was. So yeah, my dad to this day is still my hero.
Got you. That's dope.
Did he tell you any of those stories about playing ball in the 50s and the 60s? Ooh. Or what are some of those things that you took from that? Because I could only imagine and just hear stories from my grandfather from those times and – completely different situation, but what are some of the things that you learned then that helped you then that even may still help you now?
My dad was a freshman at SIU, and they traveled to Atlanta. They were in the Atlanta airport, and he came out of the restroom with a couple of his teammates, white teammates, and he just went to this fountain and started drinking. This white woman came and kicked him in his behind, kicked him. And he looked at his white teammates for direction or what to do. And they kept looking up. They just kept looking up, and their faces were red. And they couldn't say anything. They kept looking up. He was drinking at a white only fountain. And he didn't understand the divisiveness. Growing up in Southern Illinois is a little bit divisive, but not nearly as much as the South. And, so I was able to share that story on ESPN when I used to work with ESPN. They wanted me to share that on the air because Mississippi State and Loyola had that game. I don't know if you guys ever remember this, but they had to sneak away at the middle of the night to go and play this game, where it was the first time that there was an integrated college basketball game. And so they, ESPN asked me, hey, do you have any stories, or does your dad have any stories? And I said, I shared it when they're like, no, say that on the air. People need to see that. And so those are some of the examples that my dad had to deal with, some of the racism, some of the colorism, some of the, just him being separated for whatever reason that's outside of his own power. And so him being armed with those experiences and him being a college professor, he really imparted on me, my brother and sister, the importance of being proud of who you are, of, you know, you can't control what other people think of you, but basketball is a great equalizer. And so I think that's why he and my mom pushed all of us into sports, because there was a way for us to gain confidence. And as you guys know, sports, man, all that racist stuff, that falls to the side. When you're trying to win a game, when you're trying to develop chemistry, we're more alike than we're not alike. And I think that was the big lesson that my dad wanted me to learn, was that I could excel in sports and kind of sidestep some of the societal issues.
From a general standpoint, what was like one thing like that you remember? Was there a moment or a conversation that you had with your dad, you know, growing up, being a young Black man, growing into a young Black man, about how, you know, to not only be successful on the court, but also being successful after basketball? What were those conversations like with your dad as he was guiding you, being a, you know, young Black man in, you know, the 80s and in the 70s?
You know, Trey, I was very fortunate. And, you know, because again, my dad was a professor, he was able to see what was coming down the pipeline in the NCAA. So I had a number of teammates. Mm-hmm. One was a lottery pick, Nick Anderson. Mm-hmm. Marcus Liberty was the number one player in the country in high school. I had three college teammates that did not qualify because of Proposition 48. Mm-hmm. And so my dad knew it was coming when I was an eighth grader, or, you know, freshman year in high school. So I was taking the 4 years required math, the 3 years required science, mm-hmm. the English, all these things. Whereas Nick and Marcus Liberty, they were smart enough to compete in the classroom, but they didn't have that parental figure that had this information to put them in the right places. So guys, I had so many forks in the road that if I didn't have my dad, I could have easily been mm-hmm. ineligible. I could have easily been in the streets. Cause you know, I got a little wild hair about me that I kind of suppress, that likes to try to raise his head every now and then. But you know, as a youngster, I could have gotten into a lot of trouble, but I was very fortunate that I had my parents to steer me in the right direction. So those are some of the things that I remember mm-hmm. being very fortunate to have my dad and my mom in my corner to kind of help me navigate what was going on. And I'm sure you guys have a lot of the similar sentiments as well from your parents.
No, 100%. Absolutely. And what, like you said, you had your parents and your support system. Your brother went off and played for Coach Bobby Knight. I can imagine some stories he has. But what was it about Coach in Illinois that, like you said, you had schools come in a little bit after you committed, which I understand that language. What was it? Because I committed to Purdue when I was 14. So I had 4 years of high school to kind of stay loyal and stay committed. What was it about Illinois and Coach that made you say Illinois is still going to be my decision?
Great question, Raphael. For me, guys, it was, I knew that at a certain point I wanted to play in the Big Ten. It's ironic because my brother is 6 years older than me. We grew up watching Missouri Tigers because they were big mm-hmm. in that region. They were really good at the time. We watched Missouri and we watched Kentucky. So we were watching Big 12 basketball and SEC basketball. No, Big mm-hmm. 8. I'm sorry, Big 8 basketball and SEC basketball. But we both end up playing in the Big Ten, go figure. But I knew that I wanted to play in the Big Ten at some point, because out of my five visits, Ohio State, Michigan State, Illinois, Northwestern, and then I threw in Notre Dame. Because I had this fascination as a kid about the Golden Domers, and we watched Notre Dame football, and David Rivers was the point guard at the time. Digger Phelps was the head coach. I knew some guys on the team. I took a visit to Notre Dame. They had me talk to George Bush on the phone. He was vice president at the time. So I was glad I did it. I knew I wasn't going to Notre Dame. I wasn't going. But I wanted to play in the Big Ten. And I went to Northwestern. Trey's going to love this. I went to Northwestern, guys. I had my best visit.
Hurt my feelings. I think I heard this story. You hurt my feelings, Bardo. Go ahead. I'm going to let you tell the story. So I was going to ask you later, but go ahead.
So, Raphael, I go to Northwestern. I mean, man, they set it out. My boy Sean Morris is looking out for me. I hook up with a couple football players from Northwestern's team. And so we went out to a party in Chicago. Oh, it was lit. So, and you know, I wanted to be in broadcast journalism. So you can't go to a better school than Northwestern. Yep. So I come home and I get out the car and I go in the house and mom says, well, what'd you think, baby? I said, Mom, I'm going to Northwestern. I love it. I'm going to Northwestern. My dad says, son, get in the car. So we go and get in the car and we drive around town a little bit. And dad was asking me, he's like, you know, because my dad, he speaks in questions. He's always asking questions to try to pull things out of you. So he said, so you had a good trip, huh? You know, what was it that you liked about Northwestern? So I told him all the stuff, all the off the court stuff. He said, Steven, that's great. He said, but what about on the court? I said, what do you mean, Dad? He said, Steven, you're going to be the best player on the worst team in the Big Ten, and you'll be miserable. He said, you've never lost a day in your life, and you do not take well to losing. He said, you will be miserable. And I thought about it, and I said, dang, Dad is right. So we got back home. I said, you know what, Mom? I'm actually going to Illinois. Mom made Dad sleep on the couch for 2 weeks. She was hot. She was hot as fish grease because she didn't care about the basketball. She wanted her baby to get a degree from Northwestern. She knew how important it was. But my dad, okay. He knew. He was like, I know my child. I know my son. He's a baller. He does not like to lose. And at the time, Northwestern was at the basement of the Big Ten. It wasn't quite as successful, Trey, as when you were there and some of the the seasons that you had. So that's my story there.
I had the same story, but I fell for it, man. My mom was like, you got to go to Northwestern. She got off the phone with T. Hardy. Shout out T. Hardy over at Loyola.
Yep.
And it was like, you know, they're going to have tutors come with you on the planes. You could get a first class education. And I wanted to go, mind you, but she was the one that really was like, you need to be at Northwestern. Yep. My mom didn't even have that kind of personality. So it must be something with the moms with Northwestern. And my dad, I think my dad was supportive of it because I wasn't as highly recruited as you. I didn't have as many schools, especially high major schools. But it's just so, when I heard that story, I was dying laughing. And then when you said that your dad said you were going to be the leading scorer, the best player, but miserable, I wouldn't say my experience was miserable, but I know exactly what your dad was talking about because I felt that, you know what I'm saying, where you're losing and, you know, you're the leading scorer and you kind of look at these winning programs like Raphael and you're just like, dang, man, I want to play in the NCAA tournament. So was so funny when I heard that.
And guys, I've shared that on national television a few times.
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
So when you get to – so when you do get to Illinois and you – like you said, you had some ballers on that team. You had some dogs. You remember that first open gym or that first practice or that first moment where you realized that this is real?
Oh, man. You guys ever heard of Ken Norman who played at Illinois?
Yeah.
Played in the NBA, was 6'8", 6'9", like built like a bodybuilder, tough, nasty West Side Chicago cat. And why do I end up in a fist fight with him the first day of open gym? Because there's a theme that you're gonna learn throughout this. I ain't no punk. And I come from a small town, but my brother terrorized me coming up, bro. So I wasn't scared of nobody. And, you know, these cats from Chicago, they think that they're going to punk me first day. And I said, well, let me just pick the biggest bully And we went at it. And believe it or not, we came back the next day and I said, Snake, you want some more? And they looked at me like, dude, this is a fool right here. We're not messing with him. And after that, I didn't have any problems. Cause I picked the biggest bully. And you know what? You're not, cause back in the day, guys, we used to fight. You remember they used to let us fight? And then they break it up. And then you're like, you cool, you got respect. Hey, you got a couple in, I got a couple in, we're good. We keep it moving. And that's what happened. And so, you know, I think Coach Henson and those guys were a little surprised that I was that feisty and that I was that aggressive. But they quickly learned that just don't disrespect me. And we're good. I'll be the nice guy in the gym. But if I get disrespected, all hell's going to break loose because ain't nobody going to be cool after that because we're going to get some resolution one way or the other.
What do you think helped you earn the starting spot right away as a freshman at Illinois playing for a legendary coach like Lou Henson?
Great question, Trey. Again, Dr. Harold Bardo, my father, told me going into to University of Illinois, he said, if you win the drills, if you win the sprints, and we had a two-mile run that we had to do for time at the beginning of the year, he said, if you win sprints, you win that two-mile run, you're the first in the gym and the last to leave, and you play defense. He said, don't look to score. You can score your junior, senior year, but if you come in and play defense, you're going to get on the floor. And he was exactly right. And I concentrate on that. I concentrate on getting the seniors the ball where they wanted to get it. And, you know, by the 10th game of my freshman year, I was starting and never relinquished it.
Did you ever, because you came in with a highly touted recruiting class, did you ever experience any like inner squad competition, especially since a lot of you guys with Kendall Gill, Nick Anderson were similar size? Did you feel that inner squad competition or was there that camaraderie with, like, where we just want to win?
No, it was interesting, Trey, because we wanted to win, but that was probably the most competitive group I've ever been around. And so when we got inside the lines, we didn't want to do the starters and a reserve. We told Coach Henson all the time, split the team up, man, because I'm busting Nick's ass today. I'm going at KG today. And they say the same thing. And that's what made us so good. Like, we would have a fight once a week in practice. And it wasn't a big deal because, you know, you separate the guys and you see them 2 hours later and they're walking on campus having a great time. So we had crazy battles. The best games we had that final 4 year were in practice. They weren't in the games. The stuff, if we could have filmed and put, if YouTube was around then, we'd all made money. I'm telling you. Because the best stuff was in practice, wasn't in the games.
What was that year like? I mean, you're winning games, you're a national treasure, flying the Illini. What is that like, getting to that Final Four? You're saying the practices were, I mean, I can get what you're saying. The practices were unbelievable, but the atmosphere around campus, what was Coach Henson like that year? Did it at the beginning, did you guys know what the end would look like getting to that Final Four?
You know what? We knew we'd have a really good team, Ray Fell. The year before, we lost to Villanova in the second round. We were up 10 points with a minute 50 seconds left. We just didn't hit our free throws. We probably would have gotten to the Elite Eight because we would have matched up with Kentucky in the Sweet 16, and we were a favorable matchup against them. So we knew we had the potential of an Elite Eight team the year before. That disappointment really spurred our work in the summer. Man, everybody stayed on campus. We ran we were on the football field running sprints. We were in the weight room, and we were working out. And we partied together. And so that chemistry – and all that time that we spent, all that blood, sweat, and tears that we shed to try to get the best that we could be really started to culminate. And so Coach Henson was smart enough to see that this was a unique group. He kind of let us be a little bit more self-directed than a lot of his teams, and I give him credit for that because Coach Henson was a defensive guru. Now, he wasn't as strong on the offensive end, say, as a Matt Painter type or a Chris Holtman or somebody like that, that could draw something up, you know, late game stuff. That wasn't his strength, but in terms of defensive preparation, he's one of the best in the country. So as the year went on, the funny things started to happen. Nick Anderson, Kendall Gill, and Kenny Battle had to get aliases at hotels. So we would travel, we go on a road, and they had to get an alias because there were agents, there were runners, there were women, there were co-eds' mothers that were trying to get to us. There were a lot of people trying to get to us because we had so much popularity that year. And when Dick Vitale names you on national television, the Flying Illini, I mean, it was so apropos, and it was crazy. We had rock star status wherever we traveled. On campus, it was crazy. I was surprised I kept my girlfriend, who I ended up marrying, but because we, you know, it was crazy. But we had rock star status that year. It was something I'll never forget, but it was really, really unique.
Was there ever, like, jealousy? Maybe jealousy is not the right word, but, you know, Nick Anderson, Kendall Gill, those guys are first rounders, lottery picks. You know, you're the distributor, you're the defensive guy. You know, you don't have the glamorous role. Did you ever get a sense of like, man, I wish I was a little bit more of a scoring threat in college, or were you focused on your role?
No, I just focused on my role. Trey, if I scored 3 points a game and we won, I'm good.
Let's go.
You know, if I scored 20 points a game and we lost, I'm hot. Mm. I'm not happy. You know, I was always groomed by my family to be humble, to be quiet, you know, not quiet on the court, but just let your actions speak louder than what you're saying coming out of your mouth. And so, you know, when you, like Trey, you were a scorer, but me and Raphael, we're kind of agitator types, you know?
Right.
We get up under people's skin, we play a role. We could score if we needed to, but that, when you have that collection of talent, you could see that Nick Anderson was the most devastating player in college basketball on the baseline that year. Nobody could stop Nick. Kendall Gill had a package that was very unique. Kenny Battle was an unbelievable undersized four that gave us an advantage because of his athleticism. And so when you saw this uniqueness on the team, you just wanted to be a part of it because you knew it was something special. And, you know, I got drafted in the second round. I had a 10-year professional career. I have no complaints. I wouldn't change a thing because that Flying Illini experience helped me to get into sports broadcasting. It really, really did.
Right. Go ahead, Rafa.
I'll just have to throw in a question before you go there. Those defensive player of the years, I mean, like you said, y'all had some dogs in the league at that time too.
Woo!
Who were some of those guys that I want to guard? Because you got the guys that, okay, I'm going to lock him up. But then you got the guys that's, all right, I'm going to strap my shoes up for this one. So who were some of those guys for you?
Oh, man. Guys, I'll share this because a lot of times we get the recency bias and we don't really understand different eras and how tough they were. In my era, in my junior and senior year alone in the Big Ten, there were 17 first and second round draft picks in the NBA. In my junior and senior year alone. So those years when I was the best defender in the league.
Yeah.
There was Glenn Rice at Michigan, Ramil Robinson at Michigan, Willie Burton at Minnesota, Walter Bond, Melvin Newbern at Minnesota. Iowa had more talent than anybody. Roy Marble, B.J. Armstrong, Bill Jones, Kevin Gamble, Les Jepson, Matt Bullard. These are all guys played in the NBA now that I'm naming. Wisconsin was one of the lower level teams, and they had Trent Jackson, Kurt Portman, Danny Jones, Northwestern, Sean Morris, who didn't play in the league but had enough game to play in the league. Sean Morris could play. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about Kevin McHale footwork in the post. The dude can hoop. The guard from Danville, Illinois is escaping me, Trey. Dark skin, long arms. It'll come to me in a minute. He was a pro as well. He played overseas. Every team in the Big Ten, Ohio State, Michigan State, all these guys, Steve Smith, Jim Jackson, I could go on and on. I guarded everybody in that league. It was a monster. So every night, Rayfield, was like, I mean, you had to lace them up, but every player presented something unique, whether they were, you know, they had played football in high school, so they were strong and they knew positioning and, you know, all these different characteristics of all these players. But it was a gauntlet, and I loved it. I loved every minute of it.
Yeah, I mean, we experienced the same thing. That's the biggest thing I miss playing in the Big Ten is just that competition night in and night out, playing against the Yogi Ferrells, Melo Trembles, Denzel Valentines of the world, man. Like, that's, to me, more than anything, you know, getting up for those matchups and trying to prove yourself against the top-tier guys, man, that's the thing that I miss the most. I'm glad you shared that for sure.
Yeah.
And I gotta ask, too, just another one, just as a defender and as someone that I still think about this game. DJ Newble once gave me 41 at Penn State. Isaac Haas did not. It was like, you guys can understand where the Big Ten logo is on the basketball court. They ran a top ball screen. You got DJ Newble, who had a funky release come to play. And Penn State always keeps a big, solid big. So it was 2-on-1. And he came off everything. It was to the point I fouled out the game trying to get over that ball screen. So who's one of those games that you still remember that you, I mean, I let Isaac have it in the locker room. You have any of those where it still bother you to this? Well, not bother you, but you still can remember?
Well, I take great pride in saying that I held Glenn Rice to his lowest scoring total in his NCAA tournament run, which he still holds the record for most points in the NCAA tournament. Did you guys know that?
I didn't know that.
I did not know that. No, I didn't.
Glenn
know
Rice,
that.
1990. So yours truly, I held him to 29.
I held him to 29.
Right?
I understand what you're saying.
Raphael, you know what I'm saying?
No, I get exactly what you're saying.
He gave Virginia 46. He gave somebody else like 41. He was dropping 30s, man, like he was funny. Blinking an eyelash. And I held him to 29. I mean, you know what I mean? So no, I we lost on the last second shot. But, yeah, I mean – in the Big Ten, man, here's the guy that was the most underrated during our era. Do you guys ever remember Jay Burson? You ever heard that name?
I haven't.
All you people who are listening to this podcast, I want you to go back and look up Jay Burson. Jay was about a 6 foot, man, he might have been 150 pounds soaking wet. White guy, right? So y'all know how it is with the brothers. You see a guy that's like, oh, man. And I kept hearing about him. Like, he set the scoring record in the state of Ohio in high school at the time. So, you know, Coach Henson is banging in my head, you know what, Dennis Hobson's a pro, but this kid Jay Burson can play. I'm like, yeah, whatever, man. Jay Burson was wearing me out. I mean, y'all know when you're guarding and a guy starts you one way and he's got you so mixed up. I did a 360 the other way and he was gone. Jay started left and he came back right and he had me so out of bounds. I turned and by the time I turned around, he was gone. And I was like, oh man. And so in film session, Coach Henson, y'all know how it is. He ran it back 20 times.
Everybody laughed.
Tell Bardo, stay on his left hand. Stay on
the
dude, he wore me out.
Hey, were your teammates laughing, like kind of smirking in the background?
Of course. Yeah.
That'd be the funniest
thing. Until it's your turn, right?
Right, until it's your turn. Right.
It's funny until it's your turn. Oh, yeah. No, but yeah, Jay Burson. There was you guys had guys like that in the Big Ten who may not like DJ Newbill, like Rayfield said. DJ Newbill was a pro. There is no doubt about it. And so, you know, there was guys like that all the time, and he was one of them.
Nice. So transitioning from your college career, you get drafted 41st by the Atlanta Hawks. Talk about what it was like kind of being a journeyman, you know, being in and out the NBA, being overseas, going back and forth. My dad had a similar experience, and I know for him, he always says it was like the best – time of his life, but then there was moments where it was kind of like the darkest moments of his life where you're so close, but you're right there, and then you're having to go travel constantly. So talk about that experience playing in your professional career.
Well, me and Dale Demps had a very similar path, and we played against each other a lot. You know, Dale and I would go out after games and talk because your dad is a very intelligent man, Trey, and he's a tough player. I mean, physical, he's clean. Dale was never dirty until you got dirty with him.
Right.
If you got dirty with him, he come back and crack you a few times and let you know, like, okay, he ain't one to mess with.
Right.
Because Rayfield, I don't know if you've seen Dale. Dale was put together. And so, you know, it was great because we got to go overseas and you get to experience something different. I was married and had my first son at the time. He was with me in Italy and Spain and and Spain. And so, you know, from an off court perspective, it was great. Mm-hmm. But on the court, when you're in the CBA and you get a guy like Dave Jamerson from Ohio University, got called up and you've worn him out for the last month. Right. You've seen him three times and you lock him up, you wear him out, but he gets called up. And what happened for me, I used to run my mouth too much. If I'd kept my mouth shut and not had that wild hair pop up every now and then, I would have been in the league. But I was too intelligent for the NBA. Here's why I say that. Because I question coaches. You're not supposed to question people at the NBA level. And if it was something that didn't make sense, I'd ask, like, why are you doing this? And they didn't like that. And so it was the best of both worlds, like your dad would say, like the experiences of being in the NBA. Joe Dumars and I have a great relationship. Derek Harper and I have a great relationship. You know, I've got good relationships from the NBA side, but I've got even better relationships in Japan, Italy, Spain, France, Venezuela, all the different places that I was able to play. I've got these rich relationships from guys that, you know, they've got families and, you know, they aren't fortunate enough to travel to the United States and have this experience, but they got a little bit of flavor from me. And so, you know, it was like your dad said, it was the best of both worlds, man. It was great. And then it was very tough at times, because when you're going to Rapid City, South Dakota, or Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or Rochester, New York, you're going, you know, you're up at 4 a.m. after having played and, you know, your body's beat up and you're not making as much money as, like, for example, Nick Anderson and Kendall Gill. Nick played 14 years in the NBA. Kendall played 15. Those guys are that much better than me. Y'all, Trey and Rayfield, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, facts.
You know, you've been with them for years. You developed with them in college, and they're that much better.
Right?
And so, you know, that's the give and take. But you know what? I'm living out my dream now doing what we do.
Right.
Because this is great, having the ability to influence how people see the game. Yeah. And so I think that my experience not being in the NBA for 10 straight years makes my perspective and what I see even more unique and rich than maybe if I had stayed in the NBA all my 10 years.
I agree with you. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Yeah. And just being in the space you're in now, like you said, influencing, and it sound earlier when you were on that Northwestern visit, you knew you wanted to go on sports broadcasting. We'll put that bug in your ear. Because for me, growing up, and I'll just be honest about it, I mean, my recruiting story was a little different. We took a visit to Purdue. We had visits lined up that week. We were going, I think, Purdue, Ohio State. That motto had just come to my high school. Mm. We were taking a Jay Price from Illinois came to my high school. They broke into the rental car, took his radio out. But so we were going on a trip of visits, but we went up into the old Mackey. I called the old Mackey before the renovations. Paint offered me a scholarship. I was a freshman. And we didn't even make it back home. My father called. We committed. He was, this man's offering you a scholarship. It don't matter. We going. So, you know, nothing else matter. We going. So my mom was hot too. My mom wanted that. My mom wanted to be recruited. My dad was. We going. He didn't feel like Paint lied to him. He understood how Paint allowed Lewis Jackson, Etuan Moore to kind of be themselves, but also be on them in a sense. So once my father saw all of that, it was a wrap for me. But I'll say all that to say, growing up, I was infatuated with being a player, as most kids are. Like, if you want to be in basketball, you hoop, you go play. But it sounds like you kind of understood that I could be in basketball outside of just being a player. I could do sports broadcasting. How did that get introduced to you?
that man that I keep talking about, my father. So, you know, as you guys did, we grew up watching sports, watching basketball. My dad and my brother and me and Dr. Bryson, God rest his soul, who was like my second father. And he played college basketball with my dad. And so the four of us would watch games a lot of time. And Dr. Bryson and my dad would be doing the they would turn down Billy Packer because they couldn't stand him. Because they thought, you know, they thought he was kind of – I'm not going to disparage the man's name, but they didn't like the way that he did what he did. So I wanted to be an electrical engineer, but I took chemistry my junior year in high school, and me and chemistry didn't get along. It was foreign – I couldn't get it. And I was like, man, if I can't get chemistry, I can't – I was saying to my dad, I was like, Dad, I can't – if I can't do chemistry, I can't be an electrical engineer. He said, well, you like sports and you like to run your mouth. And he left the room. And I sat there like, I was like, what do you mean I like to run my, what's he talking about? And I was like, oh, he's talking about sports broadcasting. And so that kind of opened my eyes up to a whole new world. And, you know, my junior and senior year in high school, I started watching games differently. Like, I love Dick Vitale because he wasn't straight-laced like everybody. He was old, baby, you know, he had, you know, he was different. And so I really liked him. And then I got a chance my sophomore year at Illinois. Lou Henson said, Steven, you know, why don't you come on this radio show with me later on tonight? And I said, fine. So it was Dick Vitale, me, Coach Henson, Dick Vitale get on the call. And back then you had to call through telephone lines and call in to a line to get it on the radio. So the interview was over. Dick Vitale says, Steven, man, you did a great job. What do you want to do when you finished playing? I said, Dick, I want your job. And he and Coach Henson was laughing. I wasn't laughing. I was dead serious. So my dad heard the interview. He said, now this is the brilliance of a father, knowing exactly what to do in exact right time. My dad said, Steven, write ESPN a letter telling them that you're a broadcast journalism major and that upon graduation, you would like to explore some opportunities that they may have around broadcast journalism. Guys, I sent the letter off. I didn't think nothing about it. I went back to doing what college students do. I had me some 40 ounces. I'd go to class. I'd go play ball. And then I got a letter about a month later, and my teammate, P.J. Bowman, and my roommate, Ryan Baker, looking at me like, why are you looking at this letter? I said, because it says it's from the president of ESPN. I mean, I'm sorry, president of ABC Sports.
ABC.
And I said, well, I didn't send anything to ABC. I sent it to ESPN. I didn't know that ABC owned ESPN.
Right.
The president of ABC Sports, guys, was none other than Dennis Swanson, a University of Illinois grad.
Dang.
So had I not sent that letter based on my dad's advice, I may not be in this business right now. So that's the power of having a parent that gives you the exact advice when you need it. And then if you follow through, great things happen. And that started a relationship that goes on to this day. He's a great friend, a great mentor, and he's opened up a number of opportunities for me.
So was he the one that gave you your first opportunity? I think 2003, around that time with CBS Sports. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know what happened? My first job in the business was University of Illinois radio for the men's basketball team in Illinois. That was my first job. But what Dennis Swanson did, he put me into CBS Sports Chicago. So he put me in as a sports reporter. And I had zero experience. And guys, here's the thing. You don't come to markets like Chicago with no experience. This is this is one of the top three markets in the country. This is where people retire and they're big time. They fired a guy, created a position for me.
Wow.
And put me in the mix. It's unheard of. I was terrible, but I got training that really got me on the road to where I am today. And so, you know, he took a chance on me. He got me. I did the 2005 NCAA tournament, guys. I hadn't worked TV games. I'd only worked the radio. They threw me in a three-man booth with Tim Brando and Mike Jaminski. I did so well that ESPN heard a couple of games, and they hired me on right after the tournament.
Dang.
Wow.
That's how I got in, because of Dennis Swanson. Now I think I work at it. I'm okay, but right. you can't get to these positions without somebody taking a chance on you.
So you started off as a reporter. So you weren't necessarily an analyst. You were just giving the news. Were you doing all sports or just basketball?
I was doing all sports, man. And
wow.
Guys,
was that rare?
Y'all, it's very rare. You rarely see that. But I loved it, because what happened is the fundamentals of sports broadcasting are very similar to the fundamentals in basketball.
Facts.
You got to be able to go left and right. Yeah. So you got to be able to report. Sometimes you got to go live. Sometimes you got to do things on the spot. Sometimes you got to cut a package. Sometimes you got to, you know, there's a lot of similarities in sports broadcasting to basketball, and even on the sports reporting side. And so I got tremendous experience. And the funny thing is that particular experience helped me grow my brand online. Not with the television networks, but Bartle's Breakdown and the different things that I'm doing on my own. A lot of those skill sets that I learned then are really, really helping me today in what I'm trying to do online.
And it's cool that you said that, because I was going to ask, as far as being an analyst, like you said, you're throwing on TV, doing some games, but you came into it on the reporting side of it. What are some of those fundamental differences between the two? That I guess outside looking in, that someone wouldn't know.
Great question. When you're an analyst for a game or a studio, obviously you're going to be doing one sport, and so you go really deep. In sports reporting, you don't have time to go as deep, but you want to get the nuggets in the short amount of time that you have. So, for example, on a live shot, if I'm at the Berto Center covering the Bulls, which I was, and they had a blockbuster trade with Eddie Curry, got traded to the New York Knicks. I'd never done a live shot before. They just threw me out there, and I was horrible. But in a live shot, you've got there's a two screen where the person in this television station is talking. They bring you up on a two shot. You're waiting for the anchor to stop to throw to you, to toss to you. And then you go. So you're supposed to say about 12 to 15 seconds worth of information. Then you throw to a tape. So I was said something about, huge blockbuster trade up here at the Berto Center. Throw to the tape. You never say that. You never say that. And so I was with a veteran cameraman. And John Krupski, he's looking through the lens. And when I say throw to the tape and they go to tape, he goes like this.
He shook his head
like, where did they get this clown? And so now I still got to come back up on the air. Because when you go to tape, you still got to come back up. You got to save it. You got to finish the thought. And then you got to throw it back to studio. And I came back up. I was so embarrassed because I knew I didn't know what I was doing. I can't even remember what I said because I was so scared. I think my shirt was moving on the screen because my heart was beating out my chest. And so I finish, I'm driving home, and I'm worried because I think, man, I'm not going to be able to keep my job. Mm-hmm. There's a guy that was a friend who was a sports anchor in the city. And Daryl called me. He's like, Bardo, man, congratulations, man. That's a great job. He said, but dude, you suck. He's like, you need some help, bro. You can't, he's telling me all the things I did wrong. Man, I was so upset.
Oh, man.
The next day I go to the station, Carol Fowler, who's the general manager, says, Steven, I know what you have inside of you. You've got greatness inside of you, but you need training like you did when you started playing basketball. We're going to send you to Dallas for 3 days. You're going to do this training. And when I went down there, guys, I went at that like it was a NBA tryout. Most people couldn't kick me out of the building at night. I was like, well, what else can I do? How can I do this better? The report that they gave CBS Chicago, they're like, this dude is going to be really good because he wants it.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. So, so on a live shot, you have an open, you throw the tape, then you come back. And when you're throwing the tape, like what you guys do in studio, they want certain words to say that when they hear it, they know the role to take.
Right.
I didn't know any of that because I didn't have any experience. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because had I not gotten that training, I wouldn't have progressed as quickly as I did.
Yeah, because you basically had the role of like a host, essentially. Like that's kind of what the whole, like Dave and Mike and those guys do when they have to say those certain words to roll into the next segment.
That's right.
Man.
So yeah, so I got all of that experience. It was a great, and Dennis Swanson knew what he was doing. He was trying to groom me for a national color analyst, but he knew that I needed other skill sets to supplement that analyst role. It was wonderful.
Got you.
And you compared it to Hoop earlier. Now you compared it to Hoop before to me, and that really resonated with me, and it made sense. And like you said, when you started out, you weren't as good, but obviously you progressed to where you are in your career, and it's been not by chance, but by work. How, because a normal outside looking in, you don't necessarily think about a color analyst improving their color analyst game. How do you get better at this? How do you improve your skills? What are some of the things that you do to make sure that year in and year out, it's improving and it's keep going?
Ooh, y'all getting some gems here, boy. This is good. y'all got great questions. This is great. All right, here's what I do. And please, if you guys want to do this, by all means do it. Or whoever's listening, if you're in the business, by all means do this. Go deeper on the personal stories. Mm. Because that's why they call us color. We're adding color to the broadcast, right? Mm. Anybody can watch a basketball game. But what makes them want to stay tuned? Because the sound that they're hearing is complementing what they're seeing on the court. Mm. And so as many personal anecdotes or connections, what do their parents do? Did they play any other sports in high school? Was there a particular hobby that they had? Were they sports car collector? Did they, what's the center from Ohio State?
He graduated from law school?
No, he's still playing. He's from New York. God, I don't know why I'm drawing him. See, that's what happens on vacation. I lose all. It'll come to me in a minute. He's a mechanic. He's a car mechanic. Uh-huh. He's one of the tallest car mechanics in the world. And so that's a uniqueness. Keegan and Chris Murray, their dad, Kenyon, played at Iowa. He was a baller. But I don't hear that enough. Like people are tripping on Keegan Murray being the most ready NBA player right now in the draft. He showed it, got MVP of the summer league. Right. And when you're talking about Keegan, it's easy to get caught up in his talent. But what happens is if you can fill that in on the backside, that makes people want to listen to you. That's why I think I differentiate myself with a lot of people on the air, because I know, guys, it's entertainment, right? Big Ten fans are hardcore, man. We're hardcore. We want the stats. We want this. But we also want that stuff that makes us human. We're all human, right? And so if a guy, if he had a mentor that shared something with him that turned the direction of his life around, people love that stuff. Right. Because at the end of the day, we are competing with so many different outlets for people's attention. How do you keep people's attention? Make it interesting. What's the most interesting thing in the world? People's lives and experiences, to me. Mm-hmm. And that's where every year I try to go deeper and deeper. So in September and October, the three of us, whoever else wants to join, we need to go to these preseason practices. Facts. And talk to some of the assistant coaches as well.
Facts.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're going to be head coaches soon. Tavares Hardy, perfect example. I used to dog Tavares out on the air just to mess with him a little bit, right? But people like that. And he loved it because it makes people remember his name. Mm. Raphael and Trey, here's the thing. Athletic directors are listening to what you guys are saying. Some of the decisions that they're making are based on what you're saying. Mm. So you've got an incredible, incredible responsibility. It's a responsibility, right? It's a responsibility. But, you know, I encourage you guys, we can get together in the fall. We can do these preseason things, because when you go and you show your face at these places and you ask the questions, they're going to give you everything you want, because you're making the effort to get there. So that's a thing that I like to do. I like to go deep on the personal stories and bring those out on the air, because that's what people resonate with.
Yeah. You mentioned the word responsibility. I think I saw somewhere where you had gotten into some trouble for something you had said.
Oh, big time.
Can you stand upon that?
What
was said?
Yeah, I'll get very specific, because it's over with now. Here's what I'll say to start. Big Ten Network, this is one of the reasons why I love working at Big Ten Network, because they could have fired me easily, and they didn't. And they required me to be – they just said, look, stay off Twitter. We're going to take you off studio, and just be cool. And once I was, Mark Silverman, who is the president of Fox Sports now, was the president of Big Ten Network. We go out to lunch, and I'm going in to apologize. He says, stop. We're done. You were more than professional. You did above and beyond what we asked you to do. We're gonna re-sign you to a 2-year deal. Now, what happened was, and I'm gonna say it because I still feel this way. Mike Thomas was the athletic director at Illinois. He was the worst hire that Illinois has ever made. And it did not look like Illinois was going to make any movement whatsoever. And so the basketball program was not good. The football program was not good. The hires that this guy made were very questionable, in my opinion. And some of the things that he was doing, I thought, went against what Illinois was. So I went on Twitter and ripped him one. I ripped him, and I ripped the school. And so what happened was people said, wait a minute. This is a distinguished alum of the University of Illinois. If he's willing to put his neck on the line and say this to the world so that everybody can see, then there's something to this. So after I did that, I got called into the office, Mark Silver and Mark Halsey. Y'all know Halsey.
Yes, sir.
They're like, dude, can you do something? You can't say that. That you can't do that. So they were mad at me, but they didn't fire me.
Right.
I could have gotten fired easily, but they didn't. They stuck with me, and I appreciate them for that. But I was very critical of my alma mater. And guys, here's a responsibility that I'm gonna tell you guys. Now that you've got this exposure, everybody knows who you are. You're a mouthpiece for the league, and you're a mouthpiece for your respective schools. Respectfully, Northwestern, respectfully, Purdue. You have to weigh what you can say if you don't like something. Now, again, that hothead, that wild hair popped up. My dad was mortified. My family was scared because they thought I was going to lose my job. But I stand on that, and I don't regret it. I don't. I lost over $100,000 that year because of it. But I'm okay with it, because what happened was Mike Thomas got fired, and they brought in Lovie Smith as the first black head coach of a football or men's basketball team ever at Illinois.
Wow.
There had never been a black head coach. So I stand on that, and I'm okay with that. But I wouldn't advise you guys to do the same.
You probably weren't allowed to come on campus for a minute, huh?
I went to campus.
Okay.
Trey and Rayfield, I'm going to tell you guys this. There's nobody at Northwestern or Purdue. I don't care. The president, the athletic director, I don't care who it is. They've not been tied to the university as long as you have. They haven't sweat. They haven't gotten injuries. They haven't worn the jersey. They haven't been under scrutiny.
Facts.
Like you guys are, right? You guys are under scrutiny every time you go on the air, and you're still representing Purdue and Northwestern in the ultimate fashion, in a way that you all speak great, you all have very, very great insight, and you know what you're talking about. So every time you hit the air, these people are using your name and your experience as why you should come to Purdue or why Purdue is great. See what I'm saying? So nobody from the president on down can ever tell you anything about your university because you've done more than they ever will.
Gotcha.
No, it makes sense to me.
That's real.
That's why you should always tell guys, you hear guys either don't go back to their colleges or don't feel welcome at their school. I was at Purdue the other day. I was just walking around. I just happened to walk in Coach Payne's office and he was on a visit and I joined the visit. So I feel like that's the type of relationships that you should have with the school. Like you said, the school that you fought for, you bled for, you played hard for. And even like you're saying with having no regrets on standing on what you're saying, you had the responsibility to do that. It seemed as though it's more of a trend with you, even when you look back to what you were saying about the time in the league where you're not supposed to question things, but you question things. When you had those situations and they happen, and like you said, you don't regret this one. Do you regret any of them, or do you understand that that's who I am? Your father seemed as though he didn't raise you to be quiet on certain things.
No, you're exactly right, Raphael. My dad raised me to challenge. I'm a challenger. I'm not a status quo guy. I don't go along with the get along. I don't go along to get along. I'm my own person. And what happens is, you know, I run life through my filter. I don't filter through life. I do it the other way. So if you know, if there's a situation where, like, for example, I got, you know, Mark Halsey calls me because I go on my show and I'm reaming the Big Ten officials because of Johnson at Rutgers, Miles Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Miles Johnson could not stay on the floor for nothing. And I said, and in my rant, I said, this is a molecular engineering major. This is a smart young man. He can figure things out very quickly. And I spoke to him. I know Miles. He's an engaging young man. So I had to go to I went to the mat for him because I thought he was getting screwed by the officials. That's why I got love at Rutgers. From now, I can go eat at Rutgers free all day long because someone from Rutgers picked it up. They threw it up on Twitter and it kind of got viral. And so Mark Halsey, doing the right thing because he's representing the Big Ten Network. He knows how the conference works. He says, Steven, you got to be careful with this because you don't want the conference on your bad side. And I said, Mark, I've been in the conference longer than anybody in the conference office. I'm okay with that. I said, if I get on the bad side of the Big Ten Conference, so be it. Because anybody that's there, I've been associated with the conference longer than any of them. So if they got a problem with it, I'm okay with dealing with the consequences. I'm all right with it. I said, but he said, can you please take it down? I said, sure. Because that's all he wanted. That's all he really wanted. He just wanted me to take it down so nobody else could see it. And I did that. But what happened was, Steve Peichel will tell you to this day, head coach at Rutgers, he will tell you to this day that the whistles changed for them after I put the officials on blast. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have a responsibility as analysts and we can't protect all of these guys, because you guys are my brothers now. Anybody that plays Big Ten basketball, it's a brotherhood. I don't care what school you go to. And so if there's injustice anywhere, there's injustice everywhere. And that's a big thing for me.
Got you.
What have been some of the most enjoyable parts of this role for you over the years? What keeps you coming back year after year to be an analyst and to inspire the next generation?
You know, it's the love of the game, Raphael. You know, basketball, if we were to think about it, basketball has done so much for all of our lives. And, you know, if you can put – Michael Jordan said, whatever you put into basketball, it will pay you back tenfold. Mm-hmm. And if the three of us were honest, if we were really honest with our lives and we look back, in the role that basketball played, especially for Dale and me, because our dads played college basketball. Did your dad play college basketball, Raphael?
No.
Okay. So, but your dad was smart enough to understand what a good scholarship looked like, right?
Yeah. Straight up.
And yeah, you didn't regret the decision, did you?
No, I tell people every day, I made the best decision I ever made at 14 years old.
There it is. Yeah. And you got a little assistance. You made the decision.
Yeah, right.
right. So, but from the time that you started playing basketball, you got benefits as a result because you were involved in this wonderful sport. So I always bring it down to the base level for me. I got to give the game what the game has given me. I've made multi-million dollars. If you take the time that I played and the time I've been on the air, I've made multiple millions of dollars being involved in this game. That's just one aspect of it. The camaraderie, the relationships, the exposure, the places that I've gotten to travel. I've gone all over the world because of the game. That's what gets me going every year. But what really got me going, I'll be honest, seeing you guys on the air this year and Trent Meacham and Joshua Langford getting some new brothers coming in. I'm not saying brothers from a black and white standpoint. I'm saying brothers from a former player standpoint.
Right.
Seeing some Big Ten brothers, some new life come into Big Ten Network. We desperately needed it, right? And me and Sean Morris and other guy, we don't feel threatened like that. That's not what this is. There's room for all of us to thrive. Right. And the game has given us so much. That's why I approach every game, every studio appearance, like it could be my last. And I want to give a lasting impression for if there's a young person that's playing high school basketball, like, dang, he played ball too. And he's on the air. I like the way that he talks. Man, let me figure out more about him and maybe I'll go into sports broadcasting. That's it for me. Seriously. That's what it is for me. It's for the younger, it's for you guys and guys who are and young ladies who are coming behind you that want to get into this field. I want to set a level of excellence that we all can attain that we did as players as well.
Yeah, Bardo, I gotta tell you a story, man. So I was in Phoenix, Arizona last fall, summer, my last go trying to rehab my hip, but really deep down, I knew it was over because I had hip arthritis. And I saw your Instagram page where you giving tips to aspiring broadcasters, man. I called my wife. I'm like, yo, the dude that used to call our games that's on the Big Ten Network, man, he's got all these like tips. I watched like all of them like 5 times.
Oh, that's what's up,
no
man.
Lie. I was so hyped. Like, I was just like, yo, there's somebody in the space, man, that really like wants to see young, aspiring broadcasters do well. And I thought, I mean, for me, that was just so dope. So I guess I have two questions in that is one, where did that heart to just kind of give back to the younger generation come from? And two, you know, the name of this podcast is New Coverage, and it's kind of playing off this idea of the new media, you know, what Draymond Green is talking about. What are your thoughts on that as well?
To answer your first one, I've always been passionate about helping young people. I did a lot of motivational speaking, and I go to young people, schools a lot of times. So I'm big into education like my dad. He chose to go the professor route. I choose to go the sports route, but I can still educate people. And so it's always been important to me to see the younger generation do well. The reason, Trey, that you guys didn't find anything online to give you tips about getting to the business, because generally people in this business are very, I won't call them selfish, but they don't have a glass half full mentality. They have a glass half empty mentality. So there's a guy that he says he helped me, and he's a former Big Ten player. I'm not gonna put him on blast, but he said he helped me get into the business. What he did was he gave me the number of the person to call at ESPN.
Right.
What happened was the guy at ESPN saw my work on the NCAA tournament. And he was like, oh no, that's a voice that we need. Right. So this guy thought, man, I can't help you because now you're getting better games than I got. And I wanted to tell him it wasn't the number you gave me. It was that I'm better than you.
Straight up.
I'm better than you. That's what it is. And so, you know, for example, I'm gonna keep it a buck with y'all, because y'all my guys. A lot of people would be upset with Robbie Hummel, because Robbie Hummel can do things that other broadcasters can't do. ESPN and Big Ten Network and the Bulls. And Robbie's a nut. That dude works everywhere, right? But he's allowed to do things that other analysts aren't allowed to do. But I love Robbie because I think he does a great job. And right. Robbie, like Raphael, like you, Trey, Robbie actually called me and we had extensive talks before he got into the business, because we had the same agent. And right. So I love Rod. And I told him everything I could. I met with him. You know, any kind of questions he's had. He had a question this year because Purdue fans were killing him on Twitter.
Yep.
Killing him. Yep. And I told him, I was like, Robbie, you gotta cut Twitter off for a while. Just right. Don't look at it after games. Don't look at it. But my point is this, that I don't feel threatened at all. I want new blood, because quiet is kept. I watch y'all. I look for what the things that you guys do. I'm like, damn, that's good. I might need to put that in my game, right? Nice. We're all getting better. We're all supporting each other. You guys didn't feel any hate or anything towards any of the other guys. Robbie didn't come to you guys or Andy Katz didn't come to you guys and look at you as, oh man, these guys are gonna take my job. They didn't come to you like that, did they?
Nope.
No.
Now, other networks, they will, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Big Ten Network is a very unique place. It's a great place. It's a very unique place. They, for some reason, there's not that political competitive tension right. that you can feel at Fox Sports, at ESPN, at NBC, at these different places. So, you know, I hope that answered your first question. Your second question, Trey, what was that again?
Like the new media, you know, like the Draymond Green with this new media versus the old media. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
I love it. I absolutely love Draymond Green. Here, one, he's a brother of ours. And two, the thing Draymond learned, because what the you guys starting a podcast is brilliant. And here's why. All the guys that are starting to get network jobs, they have a podcast. JJ Redick, right? CJ McCollum. Kevin Durant has a boardroom. Right. LeBron has his empire where he's got his own platform.
Right.
We're the goods, guys. We're the story.
Thanks.
Right? So the reason people got mad when Draymond Green called it new media, because he knows that if you're covering basketball and you haven't played the game, you're at a disadvantage.
Mm.
I don't care if you Skip Bayless, you've been watching basketball for 40 years. You ain't never laced them up.
Facts.
Right? So what he's seeing, guys, are these media people who are feeling threatened. They have to start getting out there and throwing crazy stuff up to see if it'll stick.
Yeah. Mm.
Stephen A's of the world. He has to talk crazy, because what happens is that Patrick Beverly will come and shut him down. Right? And so people, ESPN guys, I don't know if you guys noticed this. ESPN loved Patrick Beverly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because he's not afraid to get out there. Draymond Green, not afraid to get out there. JJ Redick will call you out in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Media guys don't do that. Old school traditional guys don't do that. So when Draymond said new media, I totally understood what he was saying. I love it. And if traditional media people have a problem with it, step your game up.
Thanks. Major facts.
That's right.
Thanks.
No, Bardo, I just definitely just along these lines too of kind of going back to questions. And I was the same way with the Instagram page, dove right into it, listened to all the videos. Even during the season, I was listening to the videos on Instagram, the tips.
Kind of it's like we had a teacher in season.
Yeah.
You feel me? It's so, like we would go on air and then I go to Bardo's page and be like, okay, what do you that's a good point. Let me throw that into next time I'm in the studio. My bad, I didn't catch you off.
No, you're good. That's exactly how I was. I just want you to be able to share kind of the Instagram page, what you're wanting to do behind the Instagram. You can see it even behind you on your screen, the Bardo's breakdown. I just wanted you to have the opportunity to be able to let people know what you got going on at this point with your stuff and kind of where you're at with it. Because I mean, and I won't cut you off, but I saw it as extremely valuable. So I think as many people that can get their eyes on it as possible will help.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to do that, guys. So on Instagram, I'm at Stephen Bardo, just my name, StephenBardo. The reason I started those videos, guys, is because I put them on TikTok because all this online stuff makes me more entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I put this screen up and I've got this DSLR camera and I've got this mic and these lights and I bought a desktop computer as opposed to doing everything on my laptop is because I want to get better and better. And at some point I want this to be what I'm doing. More so than what I'm doing on with networks, does that make sense?
Yep.
Because you guys are coming up. I'm gonna have a time where my time is gonna end and I wanna be able to stay in the game. And so this is a way for me to stay in the game. And why shouldn't I give what I know to you guys or anybody that wants to get in the business? Because here's the thing, the old way of thinking was that you don't share any of your information and then you package it up and sell it. Well, I'm going to package it up and sell it, but I want people to still first get a lot of information, because why would I not want to help some young person that wants to get into the business? That makes my day that you guys say that you watch that stuff, that Andy Katz wanted to be on Bardo Life, Kevin Kugler, Lisa Byington, these are national figures. They love this online stuff because Andy Katz knows this is where the business is going. So the fact that you guys are starting your podcast, trust me, in 2 years, you're going to think, dang, we should have done this 2 years ago. But you're going to be so far ahead of the game, right? So that's why I'm so open and forthcoming with my information, because I'm setting some businesses up around Bardo's Breakdown, around Future Sportscasters Academy, that eventually I'll be able to monetize that. But in the meantime, while I'm developing my voice, I need to give as much information as I possibly can to help people like yourselves be the best that you can be. And then in turn, all I ask is that you guys figure out a way to do the same.
Facts.
For sure. I appreciate you joining us and taking the time. I think that's a great nugget to end on. Because I always tell people, you have game and you're not giving it back, you're just in the way. No matter what that game is, no matter where you were at, even I learned some of my biggest lessons. My grandfather, he was incarcerated for life, ended up doing 27 years. And
wow,
some of that game, no matter where you're at in life, everybody always got game. So I always tell people, you got game, give it back. Because some of those stories he told me, my grandfather passed a couple of years ago on his way out, it's messages that I'm going to be able to continue on with my kids and their kids and whatnot. So I always, always like to share and give it back and push the generation forward. And I think it's a lot of, especially with the future broadcasting, whether it's an academy, like you said, I think that's so big, especially in, I see kids in my neighborhood, because I go back to my neighborhood every week, it seems like, every other week. And once they saw me, they saw their camp coach, their summer league park coach on TV. They all thought they were going to be the next TV star. And the paper in my hometown up saying TV star or something. And now they don't know me for being the Purdue basketball player. They know me for being a Big Ten. So I think that type of stuff is really expanding the mind. So anything I can do or we can do to help push that, and just let us know.
And vice versa. Let me know what I can do to help you guys push your show, because I think you guys are on to something big here.
For sure. And thank you, man, too. Thank you. Because I've reached out to other folks, and, like, it's exactly what you said. People ain't really trying to help you like that. Like, I've reached out to people, and it's been like, nah, you know, just, like, real. You feel that energy. And with you, I could always tell it was different. You know what I mean? Even seeing you in passing, like, at the Northwestern game, you know, like, man, just give complimenting me, like, showing me love. Like, just a huge thank you to you, man, just being an inspiration in this business, for sure.
No, I appreciate that. You know, I got to do right by your dad, Trey. Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of it. Because, like, when I watch you and Raphael, you guys are like my nephews almost. Like, yeah, we talk about the brotherhood, but it goes a little bit deeper for you guys, because you're with Big Ten Network. And the fact when you guys come on the air and you're doing your thing, and when I saw you guys get comfortable, oh, my God. I was sitting there beaming like, I was beaming like a proud uncle, man. I was like, I'll check my guys out, man. They're doing their thing. So I appreciate you. I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Well, now, everybody, until next time, welcome to New Coverage Podcast, dropping every week. Stay tuned for the next one. From the great Stephen Bardo, we appreciate you all listening. See you guys later.